Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Success in Finance. Joining me today is Patrick Dunn. So Patrick's an experienced board member, chair and an award-winning author, as well as a business owner and founder. He's going to talk us through his career to date, with key themes being boards, the skill sets required of a CFO, and the models that he has built over the years, including his adaptation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs and their application to the CFO. In terms of his career, so he had an executive career in private equity with 3i, where he was for 27 years, before going on to become an award-winning author of the book Boards. He's also written a couple of other books as well, which had good success. So he's a founder and owner of Board Delta, and he's also chair of the EY Foundation, ESSA, the Chartered Management Institute, and he's the founder of Warwick in Africa as well. If you do want to get a discount on Patrick's book, he's arranged for a discount code to be used, which I'll post as well. I hope you enjoy the episode, and don't forget to subscribe, share and comment. You can also check out the confirmed future guests at successinfinance.co.uk. Thanks. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for joining me today on Success in Finance. How are you?
Very good, and a great pleasure to be here.
Good. Good to hear. Would you want to start us off then with a quick summary of your career to date?
Yeah. So I started life as a mathematician, got into the chemicals industry, doing operations research type work, did an MBA, then got into private equity before it was fashionable. Spent the bulk of my executive career in 3i Group, ended up on the operating committee there, and have built a number of social enterprises alongside that. These days, I have a sort of plural life, chairing a number of things and being a pretty active board member in sort of business and charity.
Great, thanks for that. Looking forward to hearing in a bit more detail about them. Going back to your degree then, you did maths and statistics at Warwick. What sort of led you into that, and how did that set you up for your next steps or your early career steps?
Well, I mean, I came from inner city Liverpool, and I'm mildly dyslexic, so there were a lot of subjects I weren't very good at, but maths I was reasonably good at. And at the time, you know, not that many people went to university where I was from, so it was slightly unusual. But I loved my maths. I love solving problems. And I think that's been a theme throughout my career. And Warwick was life-changing for me, just the whole business of going away from home, growing up properly, broadening my mind. It was a fantastic thing. And I discovered operations research at Warwick, which is sort of basically practical maths, and really enjoyed that and realised there were a number of jobs doing that. And so that's what led me to my first job.
Cool. Yeah. So you mentioned operations research there. So you went into Air Products as an operations research analyst. Can you tell me a bit about that role and how long you spent there and what you liked about it?
Yeah. I mean, I loved my first job because it was a really good company with really good training, and I think as a lesson for, you know, sort of all young people embarking on your first job, I mean, if you can get into a good company with good training, good discipline, you learn a lot. My particular job was basically in the European business, and you were basically a problem solver for the European business. So we were building mathematical models of all sorts of things, so models of logistics, supply chains, minimizing wastage in our plants, minimizing energy usage, and actually I had my first break really around using mathematical models to minimize energy usage. What struck me was that you know, early on I had a lot of exposure to senior management because you're involved in the strategic stuff, and I was advising on making decisions rather than making decisions. So what prompted me to leave was I suppose two things really. One, I noticed all the senior people were either MBAs or American, and as I couldn't be American, I thought you know, why not go and be an MBA, and that might lead me into management. So that was the story behind that.
Yeah, well, yeah, because you went to Cranfield School of Management to do your MBA, didn't you? So I'm always interested to hear how an MBA adds value then going on in your future career, because I know it's sort of good to get a few years of experience under your belt to then go and do the MBA. So, yeah, if you could tell me a bit about what you did during the MBA and how it set you up, that would be
yeah.
Good.
So doing the MBA was a bit of a risk for me because I had to give up a job, and I came from a background where that sort of, you know, didn't have a lot of financial reserves behind me, but I went there because I thought the finance, the people and the marketing were things that were sort of missing if I wanted to be, you know, a general manager. And so that's why I went. For me, the best bits of the MBA were learning from the other participants. And I guess the MBA stimulates you to do that. I was relatively young because I'd only had 4 years experience. You had to have a minimum of 4 years experience to go to Cranfield. So I was probably 6 or 7 years younger than the average people on the course, which was slightly unfair on them because they had a lot more to teach me than I could pass on to them. But, you know, some of those people on the course are still mates today. It was the absorption of a lot of information quickly, thinking about a business as a whole, all aspects of it, was just terrific. And it sets you up nicely for a career in private equity.
Yeah, I can imagine. OK, so coming out of that, then the MBA, you then joined 3i Group. What was your initial role? I know you worked your way up to communications director, but if you could sort of talk me through initially 3i and then how you progressed through the business.
Yeah, so my first job was just making and managing investments, and I joined 3i in Leeds and looked after a big patch in Yorkshire, a lot of family companies, entrepreneurial companies. We were doing startups, buyouts, buy-ins, rescues. It was terrific experience of so many aspects of business and getting involved in boards for the first time formally. I had a fantastic boss, a guy called Dave Wilkinson, who was just the most terrific coach at 3i. And he taught me so much about investment judgment, about negotiating, managing people, managing difficult people. Managing conflict is something that throughout my career, I've really enjoyed. I like working with difficult people. If you're working with a bunch of Yorkshire entrepreneurs, you're going to come across the odd difficult person. And I really enjoyed that, the challenge of doing that. I then got, after 4 years, I was promoted to and moved to London to look after what's a challenged portfolio, so companies in difficulty. And that went quite well. Then I got a job. I got over promoted, actually, which is always sort of exciting and frightening at the same time.
Yeah.
And I got put in charge of 3i's management buy-in business. And at the time, it was really not doing well. It had been launched. We'd invested a lot, not so much that wisely. It was a challenging portfolio and we hadn't got the model right. And my brief was, you know, sort this out or close it, basically. And actually, my OR background came in really handy because I decided that whereas everyone had been looking at why things were going wrong, I decided to look at those that were going right as well and understand the difference between those two things.
Okay.
And what I found, and I produced a sort of note for the board around, you know, success factors, it was called. And we completely changed the model and that came really well. And as a result of that, I discovered that when you involve the chairman and the CEO coming into the business with the existing management in the equity of the business, they way outperformed the others. And this was called a BIMBO at the time, a hybrid buy-in, buy-out. And that became effectively the model for doing buy-ins. And so I then realized that there was an opportunity within the business to completely change the way we picked selected people for the boards of our portfolio companies.
Mm.
So I then built an activity which placed about 2,000 non-execs and chairs around our portfolio companies around the world. It was very international business. Then I was made marketing director. I didn't know anything about marketing, but that was another turnaround. That went well. Alongside that, I'd been borrowed to the government for a short spell to help them with something called the Higgs Review, which was the review of how big public companies are governed. And that led to all sorts of things as a result. I then wrote a book about boards, the first one I did, which did quite well. And then I stayed in that kind of marketing comms. I also chaired the operational risk committee, did some other things, and around boards, basically then for the rest of my exec career before I retired in 2012. But 3i was a fantastic place to learn, a really good good culture. You were allowed to do things outside 3i to keep you fresh, to keep you learning. And so that's when I started to build up the social enterprises.
Yeah, because I was going to say, obviously, I think you were there for 26 years, weren't you? So what kept you interested for such a long time?
I think the very nature of the business was fascinating because, you know, if you're in private equity, it's not just one business. It's all those businesses that you're investing in. So it's endlessly fascinating. Yeah. Also, because 3i allowed me to do other things. So I was on the University of Warwick board for 9 years. I was on the Bridges Social Impact, Social Entrepreneurs Fund board. I'd built these couple of charities. So having those other things alongside the day job, I was lecturing at business schools about private equity, about boards, about these things. So I had a really rich kind of constantly learning type of experience. I had to be good at my day job. So the thing that threw out was that you always needed to meet your quarterly objectives. Otherwise, you lose the right to do these other things. And that's absolutely fair. And to be honest, the 26 years just went by like that. You know, it was just sort of gone in a flash. It was a sort of ball, really. So really, really enjoyed it.
Right, great. And what do you think the benefits were of having such a long tenure there? Obviously, it sounds like you progressed quite quickly. Like you said, you got the over promotion. So what were the benefits of sticking around?
I think in that sort of business, there is a value to knowledge. And knowing the portfolio and knowing the business and knowing the investors. So I was also responsible for investor relations and knowing the shareholders, knowing, you know, that group of people, knowing the people who could be good chairs, good CEOs in our portfolio companies. There's a value to that sort of knowledge. Of course, it can be written down. Of course, it can appear on a database. But you can't microwave relationships. Mm. And, you know, if you need someone to go and help you turn something around, take a bit of a risk with their own reputation, you know, understanding them well, having that common bond, some sort of relationship can really help. So I think it wouldn't work in all businesses. I think I can think of many businesses where I would have been bored out of my skull had I stayed that amount of time. But given the particular nature, we were expanding internationally. So I spent, you know, every week I was in a different country, probably for 20 years. So constantly learning, constantly challenged, and it was never really dull.
No, sounds great, and I can tell that you definitely enjoyed your time there. I don't know how much you can talk about this, but are there any portfolio businesses that you sort of think back upon fondly, or you remember an interesting story or turnaround story that you can talk about?
There are a whole number, really. So I really enjoyed what I did with SR Technics in Switzerland, which when Swissair went bust, it had a big repair and maintenance operation, and there was a great danger that would fail, that, you know, several thousand people would be out of work. And 3i had the insight, because it had an investment in Go, which was sold to EasyJet, that the low-cost airlines at the time weren't finding it easy to get repair and maintenance services. So we decided to reposition SR Technics into the leading provider of services for the low-cost airlines, and went to the Swiss government and did a deal, and that business has succeeded, you know, really succeeded. Been really successful since, and actually created quite a lot of employment as well. So it was nice from a financial point of view, nice from a human point of view, and actually nice to be part of an industry that you know has really changed the sector. There are many others in terms of, you know, startups that I can think of, or things that were saved, but I particularly like that one.
Cool. So yeah, like you said as well, you had a lot of external opportunities whilst you were at 3i, and I know you sort of sat on a few boards. So you mentioned the Warwick Foundation. Do you want to talk to me a bit about that?
Yeah, so I was actually on the University of Warwick board itself, so for the whole university, but also I founded Warwick in Africa. And Warwick in Africa is a charity that's part of the university. And we basically teach children maths and English in slums and in rural areas. And we started in 2006 in Johannesburg. And today, you know, we're in Ghana, Tanzania, South Africa, and we're just starting in Kenya. And we've helped about 750,000 children since we started. And we've trained probably around 5,000 teachers who've been through our programs. We get probably 30-40% improvements in the children's results. And it probably costs us about £10 a month to teach a child. And the reason we're able to do that is because we use volunteers. Volunteers compete to take part. We train them, we assess them, and they do the most amazing job. And so that's been a big part of my life since 2006. And it's hugely fulfilling. And actually, I think going back to 3i, I think having something like that alongside the rarefied air of private equity is really helpful to ground you and to keep you in touch with, you know, frankly, how so many people in the world live, that the world of private equity is rarefied, and there's a great danger that you become disconnected if you live in those sort of environments for too long without getting out.
Yeah. Okay. And how did you go about actually founding that? Was it sort of your idea that you mentioned to the board and they were behind you, and then you just sort of ran with it?
Yeah, so that's pretty much how it was. I'd supported another scheme which became the Further Maths Network in the UK. And this was the idea that many schools in disadvantaged areas in the UK had dropped Further Maths from the curriculum. If you don't do Further Maths, you couldn't go to top universities for maths like Warwick, Imperial, Oxford, Cambridge, those sort of places, which is outrageous, really. And so Warwick started, you know, through its students and faculty, supporting teachers in local schools to put Further Maths back on the curriculum. And I thought, this idea of supporting teachers, because I'd read about big problems in Africa around maths education, could work there. So I went to the university and said, you know, how about we fund a pilot? Everything I've done in the social enterprise area, we've tended to start with a pilot to see how it works, to get the model right, and then to scale it. Classic venture capital kind of business building. And so we started with 12 volunteers in 2006, and we funded the flights, accommodation, vaccines, you know, all that stuff. We trained them, we measured what impact we were having, and then we realized, actually, whoa, this is really big bangs per buck. The university were absolutely brilliant in providing all of the support, the infrastructure that you need around something like that, and that made it much easier than just starting it up, you know, on my own. So doing it in partnership with the university has been brilliant, And actually, Warwick in Africa led to the creation of ESSA as well, which is Education Sub-Saharan Africa, which works on big systemic issues in African education, but maybe more of that later.
Well, let's move on to the various board positions you've had. I know some of them were probably concurrent, but should we start with LEAP Confronting Conflicts?
Yeah, so I mean, I grew up in quite a difficult place, and when I was at 3i, probably around 2002, I had a sort of restlessness to do something else and to do something to help young people who came, you know, from backgrounds like mine. And I came across LEAP. It was really a big project rather than a big charity. It had, you know, a couple of hundred thousand income. It didn't have a website. It had a tiny team. Didn't have any serious money. And I thought the model that it had, though, for helping young people manage conflict more effectively was absolutely brilliant. And the training that LEAP gave young people to be more effective at managing conflict, I thought was fabulous. So I thought, I joined the board and not long after became chair, put a little bit of money in as well. And we've grown LEAP to the force it is today. And it's probably the leading charity in the whole space in Europe around helping young people manage conflict. We work in 14 prisons. We work with gangs in difficult estates across the country. Amusingly, many of the techniques that we train young people to use are really relevant in the boardroom. So I found very quickly myself adopting sort of ways and of tackling kind of conflict. And I in fact, LEAP makes a reasonable amount of sustainable income from training corporate people how to manage conflict more effectively. So lawyers, you know, CEOs, M&As, bankers, whoever they might be, and that generates income, and that's delivered by young people. So probably, I don't know, 20% of our income will come from that source now.
Wow. Okay. And what, as the chair, what sort of things were you involved in? I know obviously it'd be very strategic, but yeah, what was your input?
So I think generally, I mean, if you look at the role of the board and the chair is kind of the leader of the board, if you like, so those two things are usually aligned. And so I'd say, you know, it's making sure you've got the right vision and strategy, making sure you've got the right resources and making sure you've got the right governance. That's what the chair does. That's what the board does. But you can't really talk about the role of the board and the role of the chair without thinking about the role of the executive. And I think the role of the executive is really to develop and deliver the business plan, then to maintain financial and operational integrity. And I always have this image in my mind of a Venn diagram where you've got kind of the board and the exec as the two circles, and you've got this really neat intersection. And that intersection, if you're in early stage and startup organizations, is bigger than it is in public companies. But it's always got at the heart of it the big things that you need to decide together, like strategy, the big people stuff, those sort of things.
Yeah. No, that's a nice bit of imagery there. I like that. Okay, so then you were at, was it D3O?
Yeah, so actually that was later. That was when I retired, and a friend in another fund asked me to, the previous chair had suddenly become ill, and they were mid-fundraising, and it needed a number of things to change. And so I was asked if I could step in at very short notice and chair that for a bit, which I did. So we raised, D3O makes protective materials. So these may go into phone cases or motorcycle suits or helmets, things like that. It's a fabulous little business. And so we moved from Brighton to Croydon. We raised 10 million. We you know, developed the team and so on, and then I handed it on to someone with more of a marketing background, which is probably what it then needed for its next phase. I've always been, because of in private equity, you do always thinking that any role you have is just for the next phase.
Yeah,
it's not forever. So despite my longevity at 3i, I've always seen, you know, like with Leap, I decided, you know, 9 years was enough to chair, and it was really important that you build in the sustainability, you build in proper succession, so nothing becomes dependent upon you.
Yeah, absolutely. And how did you go about the fundraising for that? You said you raised 10 million. So was there anything special that you had to do, or was it just your standard?
I guess by that point,
you were quite well connected as well in terms of contact.
That helps. But you know, friends don't want to lose money either. So, and it's just hard work. Fundraising is hard work. You know, unless you're in a raving hot market, fundraising is hard work. You have to demonstrate, you know, you've got a good proposition, and that the investors will get a return from it. And in early stage things like D3O was, you know, you're looking at all the risk as well, and trying to cover that off.
Yeah. Okay. So then, yeah, other roles you've done. So you were at the Chartered Management Institute. I think were you chair there as well?
So I'm a trustee of the Chartered Management Institute.
Right.
But I'm chair of the oversight board for the Chartered Management Consultant qualification. That all sounds a bit of a mouthful, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But to explain the difference, so the Chartered Management Institute is a royal institute, and it accredits management qualifications. It's been very successful, and the new Chartered Management Consultant Award is basically trying to give a kite mark to consultants. So whereas you know, if you're an accountant, you get your accountancy qualification. That's a badge of honor, and it means something to clients. It means something to investors, and so on. There wasn't anything like that for management consultants. So. There's a joint venture between the Management Consultants Association and the Chartered Management Institute to create this qualification. And they asked if I would oversee the creation of that. And we're probably a year into that. It's going really well. We've got our first 1,000 chartered management consultants. We've got a lot of the big firms in the industry behind it. And we're now looking to scale that up as well.
Great. Well, yeah. Could you tell me a bit more about the qualification itself? Because, yeah, I don't know too much about it. And you're right. Yeah, you don't really come across management consultants that have that sort of accreditation. So I think it's a great initiative.
Yeah. So we could probably spend a whole hour on this. So I'll be really short. the qualification works for very senior people, mid-level people and more junior people, so it's relevant to the stage that you're at, and like most qualifications, it's essentially assessing competencies to do the job. So looking at the relevant aspects of being a consultant and just testing whether that person's got those things and whether they can demonstrate those things. So it's really quite straightforward. And some of that might be accrediting a firm's training so that its training actually will meet the standards that are required for those people who go through the training to become a chartered manager. Some of it's just down to, you know, assessing an individual. And it's for not just those in very large firms, but also, you know, can be for much smaller firms as well. We've got quite a range of people now taking part in the pilot. So if anyone's listening and they'd like to know more, look either on the Chartered Management Institute website or the Management Consultants Association website, or just search for Chartered Management Consultant and you'll find out more.
Cool. And you mentioned it was a specific set of skills that you're looking for. I'm not going to ask you to list every single skill, but can you give me a rough idea? I mean, I can imagine the sort of skills that you think are required in a management consultant.
Yeah, so they'd be the obvious things relating to the area of consulting that you're doing. So if you're in digital consulting, for example, that would be competencies around that. Clearly, project management consulting would be that. Clearly, measuring, tracking the impact of the work, those sorts of things. Teamwork, a whole set of, you know, you just break the job down and look at what are the characteristics that are required to be successful doing that, and then you test whether they're there.
Okay, so is it tailored then to each business, or you have to sort of, just going back to what you said previously, do you look at on an individual basis, like they work at this company and we know their training is appropriate, therefore
the individuals still have to be assessed,
right?
But actually we have a team of assessors who will assess, who are a mix of experienced consultants and experienced management assessors, and so they'll decide, you know, what sort of assessment is required for that thing. But there are some generic competencies, and then there's some specific things around the particular nature of the thing.
Okay, no, sounds interesting. I've got way more questions, but as you say, we've got plenty to cover, so so we'll move on. So then you mentioned earlier education sub-Saharan Africa. So again, is that another sort of charity?
Yes, so in building Warwick in Africa, I became increasingly frustrated by big systemic issues that were getting in the way. So for example, we would help young people to get really good grades at the equivalent of GCSE or A level, but then they would find it incredibly hard to get into university because there weren't enough places, or they couldn't get a scholarship. And there weren't enough places because there's a desperate shortage of faculty. They couldn't get a scholarship because they'd never heard of a scholarship. They didn't know where to apply. They didn't know how to apply and all of that sort of thing. So that was really frustrating. Also, I saw a lot of investment being made in education in Africa, which seemed to be made with a sort of hope rather than evidence. And so I thought, why isn't proper research being used before people invest in quite large amounts of money? And one thing, when I started to look at what was the research that was available, was it was very difficult to find African research. You could find stuff from Harvard, Warwick, UCL, wherever, but finding African research was hard. So I thought you could actually set something up which actually really focused in on these big challenges. So the first thing we did was build a database of all the research that we could find of quality done by Africans on African education. Yeah. And that database has 3,500 pieces of research in it. It's free, it's searchable, it's showing where there are gaps in research, it's highlighting really talented researchers who no one had ever heard of, and all of that. So that's been a big success. That was our first project. The second one was to, back to operations research, I suppose, was to model the shortage of faculty. So we actually looked at, in Ghana, what is the shortage of faculty by main subject category area, and discovered that Ghana only has half the faculty it currently needs. And with population growth, that problem is just getting worse. And then you start to think about, well, what can you do to solve that problem? And the third thing was we looked at 350 scholarship programs and worked out what would be a good set of KPIs for a scholarship program. Worked out what were the characteristics of the most successful scholarship programs, so the lowest dropout rates, the best achievement rates post-scholarship. That had an echo of my work at 3i on looking at, you know, management buy-in success factors. It was the same process, just different variables and different sort of thing. That was adopted by UNESCO in the latest Global Education Monitoring report, and now a number of foundations are adopting that way of doing scholarships. So the research database, the demographics of faculty, and the scholarships have really been big wins for us. It's still a small organisation. We're only 4 years old. We've got a team of 10, but we've got a majority African board now and a majority African team, and we're really making good progress.
Good, great to hear. And how do you fund the sort of the work that you're doing?
So with ESSA, for example, I seed funded that and then was very fortunate in getting 1 million euros of funding from the Robert Bosch Foundation in Germany, a terrific foundation who supported our sort of from startup and early stage. We've then, because of the nature of the work, managed to get project funding from MasterCard Foundation, Jacobs Foundation, Dubai Cares, and others. It's very hard work raising money for charities, very difficult to get unrestricted funding. It's not easy, but it's much easier to get restricted funding. So funding for projects. It's very hard to get funding to build an organization. That's the hard bit. And that's been the same at EY Foundation as well.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. Well, do you want to talk me through EY Foundation now you mentioned it?
Yeah, so I love it really because EY had a couple of programs that it was running for young people with, in challenging circumstances, generally on free school meals. And it thought actually these are working really well. There's a lot of there's a lot of volunteering involved in it. They're having quite a lot of impact on the young people, but they're really small and they're really London centric. I knew EY well through 3i because EY were 3i's auditors, and if you're in private equity, you mix with the big four quite a lot. And they knew that I'd had this background at Leap and been involved in social enterprise and had a passion for helping young people break through the sort of that breaks of the barriers that exist, even more relevant today, by the way. And so they said, well, would you be interested in helping us create a foundation, be the founding chair, and make this something national and of scale? And I thought, wow, the opportunity to use EY's brand to have a team, a high quality team straight away, to have the financial support and the convening power that EY has got, you could really do something quite significant here. So we founded the foundation in 2014, and today we operate in 17 cities. We have five programs. We've helped about 13,000 young people. We've revolutionized work experience for those young people because we have a couple of hundred corporate partners, and the work experience is really, it's tough. So, you have to do something useful for the corporate, for the employer. They have to do something useful for you. We have to measure what it is that what the outcomes are. And they will get probably a year's coaching, mentoring on top of that, and support. We think that there's no point just helping young people become more employable. You have to help employers become more receptive for young people with those sort of backgrounds, re-engineer work experience, and so on. So at the moment, we're working on a number of very exciting propositions to grow the EY Foundation. If anyone out there is interested in helping us, just get in touch.
Great. Now again, sounds like another really good initiative. And then finally, in terms of your board positions, do you want to talk me through Board Delta?
Yeah, so Board Delta is probably the easiest because it's my consultancy business. So I when I retired from CI, a lot of people were asking me, can you help me with this board or that board? And I'd done a lot of training around board skills and all of that before, helped the FT set up their non-exec activities, BVCA, Invest Europe, and so on. And at the beginning, I was just doing this for free, just for fun, for my mates. And then I just thought one day, actually, there's probably a nice little business here. So I didn't spend any money on marketing. I came up with the name myself because it's Board and Delta fused. Delta, obviously, for the mathematicians out there, that's difference. So it's about making a difference to boards.
I
And
like it.
so we basically focus on a couple of activities. So helping boards at some point of transition. So at the moment, I'm helping a private equity backed business that's basically got two fantastic opportunities, and it's separating these two businesses to increase the focus and grow them more successfully. I'm helping a very large charity in the global south that's changing the way it's being governed. I still work with the FT and the BVCA and Invest Europe on board training, and a number of other private equity firms around that. So it's a range of, you know, fairly intensive consultancy projects plus training, and it's great fun. I really enjoy it, and it's actually another social enterprise in that a decent chunk of the profits every year go to one of the the charities that I'm involved in.
Yeah, that's great. Cool. Well, obviously, from our discussion so far, it's evident that you've got lots of experiences with boards. So you went on to write your book, Boards, which for the listeners, you've kindly arranged for a discount on that, which I'll post details of alongside this recording. But do you want to talk me through the inspiration to write the book itself and then some of the themes within it?
Yeah, sure. So I'd written a number of books a number of years ago. I mean, I think I did my first book in 97. It was imaginatively called Running Board Meetings, because I'd been to some really rubbish board meetings and thought there must be a better way to do this. And I tried to buy a book and I couldn't find one. So I had to go and wrote one. And that did quite well. And then I wrote a book around Director's Dilemmas, which was a series of case studies, real situations that you find yourself in. And then I did a non-exec handbook, and I did that all I suppose the last book was published in 2003. And then I got really bored of doing that, because if the book is successful, you have to do new editions.
Yeah.
And to be a new edition, you have to change 15% of the content. And by the time you've done three of these, you're fiddling around for fiddling's sake. And I really didn't want to do that. And at that time, I was also very involved in growing Leap. 3i was incredibly busy, and so on. So I gave it a rest for a bit. But last year, I'd been sort of, the FT had been agitating for me to do another book, because they wanted a course book for their programs, and they wanted something practical and something that would be helpful for boards, not just big public companies, but smaller companies, not just business, but charity and public sector and so on. So I've always, because I'm sort of mildly dyslexic, I tend to use symbols a lot. So if you're looking for a couple of symbols from the book which capture it, the triangle of purpose, people and process, to me, is really fundamental. If you want to get, it's not just a board, actually, if you want to get an organization working, having clarity of purpose and alignment behind that, getting the right people working together in the right way, and having good, straightforward process, it tends to work. That's sort of my experience. So it doesn't sound very clever, does it, really? But the structure of the book is purpose, people, process, and breaking those things down. And then some new dilemmas, yeah. Some real situations that you can then sort of almost have a go in the simulator, and see what it's like to be on a board in that situation, and figure out what you would do. I guess the biggest bits of the book are around the people stuff. There's quite a chunk around decision making, because I think that's really fundamental to a board's success. It was great fun to write. I did it in about 6 months elapsed time. And it was more of an outpouring in one sense.
Yeah.
But in another sense, I have some views on things, and I didn't want to just have views on things. I wanted to see if I could justify those views. So I did quite a bit of research to see what was out there to actually in any way prove what I might think. Yeah. So, the other thing that the book contains is quite a lot of links and suggestions of other books and things like that. So if you're interested in a particular thing, then, you know, go look at this type of thing. It's got, you know, a reasonable amount around managing conflict in it, is what probably what you'd expect. It's got a lot around picking the right people, those sort of things. And then it's got, you know, stuff around the plumbing of a board, which is what all the process stuff is. How do you make it work in practice?
Yeah. Just to go back there onto the decision making, what sort of things do you highlight in relation to decision making?
So I think one of them is around self-awareness. So being aware, you know, as a company, if you like, if it's a business, what you can really do with what you've got, because so many decisions people take aren't linked to their resources. So you make a decision which would be great if you had a much stronger FD, or great if you had a much stronger sales team, or great if you had a much better product, but you don't.
Yeah.
So I think that first thing around self-awareness is important, and understanding your biases. So I spent a bit of time in the book talking through, you know, the common biases and how they influence decisions. I also talk about distinguishing between facts and interpretation, because often when you make a decision, you don't have all the facts. You have to make some interpretations. And as long as you're clear which is which, so you know what the degree of uncertainty is, and you can track that and adapt as you go, then you're fine. I think the other thing is around consequences. So I think often when we're making a decision, we don't really think through all of the consequences and how they interrelate. And my best example of this is, you know, often people do market research, say we're going to come up with a new product. It's going to be better, cheaper, you know, lovelier than anything else in the market. Whippy. And we'll have margins of this. And what you often don't see in the paper is any sense of how competitors will respond to that. So how long will we be able to retain that high margin? Because the next people, you know, they'll want to leapfrog as quickly as they can. And people are often unrealistic about product life cycles, about how long those extra margins for superior performing products will actually last. So there are many aspects of decision making. I mean, I talk about judgment as well. I think that's, you know, really critical. And getting people on a board who've got really good judgment is fundamental to success.
Cool. And then on the people side, obviously, you mentioned that picking people is quite important. Specifically around the CFO, obviously, this podcast is called Success in Finance. So I'd like to get your input on what you think a good CFO looks like. You've obviously worked with many, I'm sure, good and bad. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, a long time ago at 3i, I asked the question, what makes a really good CFO? And I couldn't get a really clear answer. So I thought, well, why don't we do some research? Why don't we look at what are the characteristics of the best performing CFOs in our portfolio? Yeah. And why don't we look at the characteristics of those at the other end of the spectrum and see what the difference is? And we came up with what I call a sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs approach. So for those not familiar with that, you know, what must you have? And then what's nice to have? And what would you have in a dream world? And at the base of that sort of triangle of needs was integrity. You have to trust the CFO. And those people who, you know, if you lose trust as a CFO, you can't do your job. You know, the board has to trust you. The rest of the team has to trust you. The funders of the business have to trust you. You have to have relevant technical competence. So your technical competence needs to be relevant for that business. So if it's an international business, you need treasury management experience and so on. You need management skills. So, you know, you've got to manage a finance function. You need management skills. If you're going to be part of the leadership team of the organization, you need to have management skills. You also need sales skills. And this surprised a number of people. They said, you know, well, what do I want my finance director having sales skills for? Well, one of my favorite finance directors is Rosie Drinkwater, who's the finance director at Warwick University. And she's superb at this because she's managed to persuade you know, academics, leading departments, of the need for good budgeting, good forecasting, financial control. That takes sales skills to do that. If you're a public company, you know, you have to persuade investors to invest in your stock, all of those sort of things.
Then so you need the influencing and persuasion side of it is the sales skills.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you need board skills. You know, if you want to be on the board, you need board skills. You need also strategic skills, because if you want to be more than the numbers person and not confined to the numbers role, you need to take part in strategic discussions. And to take part in strategic discussions, you need to understand the basics of strategy to be able to do that. I mean, in an ideal world, if you were a chair sort of looking at this, you think also, you know, pretty handy to have a CFO who could step up to CEO if something happened to the CEO. Yeah. You know, so CFOs are usually in the succession pool for the CEO, but you can be a perfectly good CFO and not want to be a CEO, or not have all of the skills that you need to be a CEO. So that's why it's at the sort of top, really. And obviously, if you're a CFO and you want to be a CEO and you want to be a CEO now, that's really setting up a conflict with the current CEO. So, you know, that needs managing carefully.
And what are those skills that, if you did want to take that step from CFO to CEO, what are the skills that you'd have to work on?
They may be the more entrepreneurial type things. So maybe seeing gaps in markets, seeing opportunities that others don't see, which you don't necessarily need to have to be a CFO, but you really need to have if you're a CEO.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Okay, well, thanks for that. Some good ideas there that you've mentioned. Were there any other relevant ideas from the book that you wanted to mention at all?
I think one thing that seems to have resonated a lot is that I've used the normal distribution, so a bell curve. Mm-hmm. And on the vertical axis, I've had effectiveness, and on the horizontal, pressure. And I've said basically it's the job of the board to manage the sort of organizational pressure so that you maximize effectiveness. And what I see a lot of people doing is when a team is under stress, so maybe they're on the sort of halfway down the right-hand side, you know, long before a headless chicken, but they're trending that way. You know, the job of a board actually is to make it less pressured rather than more pressured. But our instincts when the team is struggling is probably to put them under more pressure rather than less. And I think this applies to individuals. And I've seen CFOs, really good CFOs, are very good at that. And so as you're developing, I think managing your own balance of effectiveness and pressures a pretty handy thing to do. So you're never overstretching yourself, but that doesn't mean you're not stretching yourself.
Yeah.
You're never lounging about. You know, you're never coasting.
Yeah.
You know, there's always something extra you can do. And for many CFOs who I've watched transition into CEO, they've done that by assuming additional responsibilities to their CFO role.
Yeah.
Because that gives them a broader experience base, and it means they're less likely to be confined to, or to be seen as being confined to, the CFO role.
Okay, now that's another interesting model. Yeah. Okay, so what's next for you then, Patrick?
Well, more of the same, I hope.
Yeah.
I mean, I love what I do. I'm very privileged with the things I chair. I've got really good teams I enjoy working with. I love the Bordelta consultancy. I've got some ideas for some other social enterprises, but I'm being careful at the moment. I mean, the current environment is really challenging for everybody, and so I'm focusing my efforts on making sure the things I'm already involved in are sustainable and going to do as well as they can through this, rather than start something else up new just at the moment. But, you know, hopefully this will pass, and I'll end up having a bit more time to do something else.
Absolutely. Okay, I was going to ask what advice would you give to aspiring CFOs, but I guess you've sort of covered it with your hierarchy of sort of requirements. So what are the three key attributes that have enabled you to have the success that you've had?
Well, I think I've been incredibly lucky. So opportunities came my way at just the right time, and you can't plan for that. But what you can do is take them.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, you know, there have been moments where I thought, shall I, shan't I? I remember, you know, being really unsure whether I should, you know, take up the offer to be the marketing director at 3High, knowing nothing about marketing.
Yeah.
But what made me do it was someone I trusted believed in me more than I did.
Yeah.
And I think trust the people who've got your back, trust the people whose judgment you respect, and listen to them carefully. And I think the second thing, actually, I learned from my Irish grandmother, who said, you know, it's really important to listen to what people say, but it's even more important to listen to what they think. And if you can read a room, look at what might be in the thought bubbles, particularly if a CFO, I think that's really, really helpful. And yeah. The final thing, I think, is around managing conflict and knowing when to compete, when to collaborate, when to compromise, when to avoid, when to accommodate, you know, with that person in that room on that day, with that atmosphere, you know, learning the art of that can be tremendously helpful in terms of avoiding mistakes and avoiding broken relationships. And that sort of thing.
Okay, cool. So I think, I don't know if I picked up four there, because I think you sort of had take opportunities.
Yeah.
I know you said you were lucky. trust the people that have got your back. And then also, it's important to listen to what people think as well. And then just managing conflict.
I cheated.
I'll take four. We've got a bonus one, Patrick. So thanks a lot for that.
Yeah.
Well, look, it's been great to hear about your story and all of the good work that you're doing as well on the sort of foundations that you're working with. So I really appreciate your time, Patrick, and it's been great to chat.
Absolute pleasure, and good luck with the podcast.
Thanks a lot. So that was Patrick Dunn. I hope you enjoyed listening to Patrick's story. It was really good to hear his interpretation of boards, given the vast experience that he's had through his time in private equity, and now as his various roles as chair on a number of different boards. It was also really useful to hear the skill sets that he believes are required of a CFO and the way that he demonstrates that through his adaptation of Maslow's hierarchy. It was also really useful to hear about the Venn diagram that sort of overlaps the board and the CEO, and to hear about the importance of people and processes as well. In terms of three key attributes that he mentioned, he actually mentioned four. So it was number one, take opportunities when they're given, trust the people who have your back and pay attention to what they say. But he also said it's important to pay attention to what other people think as well. So almost reading the speech bubbles around them as you look around the room. And finally, he said it was really important to manage conflict. As I said, if you do want a discount on his book boards, I've posted in the episode description the details of that. Really good read, so do have a look at that. As always, don't forget to subscribe, share and comment, and you can find a list of confirmed future guests at successinfinance.co.uk. Thanks.